Hello, and welcome back to Slut PhD. I'm your host, Julie Fennell, and thank you for joining me as I talk about reframing disorganized attachment. As always, this podcast is intended for listeners who are legal adults in the area where they reside. So if you, like me, are in the United States, that means that I expect that you are age 18 or older. Today's episode has plenty of trigger warnings. I will be talking a fair bit in vague but not explicit terms about childhood trauma and a fair bit about breakups and romantic issues as adults. So if that sounds like something that would be too much for you today, then maybe skip this or come back to it later. Also, if you're my ex and you're listening to this, I'm sorry. So if I didn't have to worry about copyright issues, I would have opened this episode playing clips from Katy Perry's song Hot and Cold, and also the song You Could Drive a Person Crazy from the musical Company. So if you want to pause while you are listening to this and go find those songs on YouTube really fast, it's especially fun to watch Katy Perry in concert performing Hot and Cold because she did this crazy costume change thing that she paid someone gobs of money in order to be able to do. But the reason that I really like both of those songs to talk about disorganized attachment is that I feel like they so beautifully embody what has now become a existing body of psychological research on the way people with a particular set of problems come to relate to other people romantically. And in the case of You Could Drive a Person Crazy, that actually predates the research on disorganized attachment by a fair bit, especially if you're talking about disorganized attachment in the context of romantic relationships. So it's interesting to see the way that poets have observed this experience in real life. That said, my main thesis today is that most of attachment theory, as you can find it, which I will go over in great detail, doesn't really make a lot of sense. And I think that if you recontextualize some of the findings and experiences of people with regards to attachment using the psychological paradigm of behaviorism, I think you can make a lot more sense of everything that you find. And most importantly, I also think that disorganized attachment, which is also called anxious avoidant, just sort of accidentally happens to be real. And I'm going to explain how that came to be. And why, in a lot of ways, it's much better understood, conceptualized, and treated as an issue of relationship conditioning problems, or perhaps one could argue relationship learned helplessness, but I think that might be a little bit of an oversimplification. I also hasten to add that this is not an unusual or out there observation. Going all the way back to the late 60s, there were behaviorists who had started to look at attachment theory, and they were like, why this makes way more sense if we put this here. Why is it being put over in this camp? But then they just sort of dropped it because a lot of the research on this was pretty sketchy, and it has unfortunately remained very sketchy. But I'm going to go over all of that in great detail for the rest of the episode. So I just want to begin all of this with kind of the caution and preference that in general, pop psychology tends to be pretty problematic, right? So in the 90s, you had hit books like Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. And like in general, a lot of times things that appeal to the masses just turn out to not be very real. Like there's certain things that maybe people feel validated by, but that doesn't mean that they're actually real findings. And so, you know, the idea that there's these huge differences between men and women is not well backed up by research. There are definitely some differences between men and women on average, but it's easy to exaggerate what those differences are. Also, you know, if you've ever taken a Myers-Briggs personality test, you might have felt super validated by it, and maybe your own personal experience continues to back up some of the things that you found or read in it. I know for myself, like, I'm an INTJ, and like, I am very surrounded by other INTJs, which I think is pretty funny since it supposedly constitutes a very small percentage of the population. Cool. That's great, except it turns out that Myers-Briggs is about as valid as astrology, which unfortunately also is mostly not validated very much by science. We like Myers-Briggs because it gives us an acronym to walk away with, and it gives us a set of cute little descriptions and divides our lives into 16 little boxes. But the reality is that if you really want to know something about your personality, you have to go take a big five personality test. And the results are going to be pretty nuanced and complicated because humans are nuanced and complicated. And if you do the math, if I've done it correctly, which I don't promise that I have, I think you end up with about 225 possibilities there. Please don't quote me on that, but usually you end up dividing a big five into low, medium, and high for each category. There's five categories, and then each of those different possibilities can be recombined with any of the others. It's a lot. It's a lot of possibilities, and that's way less convenient than walking away with the kind of little descriptor that you get from a nice tidy Myers-Briggs test. In general, I'd say the simpler the paradigm or information that you receive is, the more skeptical that you should be of it. Humans are extremely complex creatures, and whenever you get apparent psychological wisdom that seems like it's so obvious, actually, a lot of times it isn't. And unfortunately, such is the case with attachment theory paradigms, which have really swept through queer communities by storm in the last few years. Although it seems, as far as I can tell, that the straights are a little bit oblivious to all of this. Attachment theory with regards to children is basically mainstreamish psychology, but with reference to adult romantic relationships, I think you could probably more accurately describe it as sidestream psychology. There's a lot less research on it, and it seems to be treated with much more skepticism. You can certainly tell that if you look up attachment theory on Wikipedia, you'll see like a single line just happening to note almost in parentheses that attachment theory has been applied to adult romantic relationships. It's very under-researched, to put it politely. But what is attachment theory? It starts in the late 1950s with some controversial experiments by a man named John Bowlby. And they were further developed by one of his, I think she was a student, Mary Ainsworth. And they were a series of experiments and observations that were mostly focused on the dynamics between young children and their mothers. And over the years, these experiments and observations were replicated and expanded upon. There's some that are sort of in real-world situations, there's some that are in these experimental conditions. But over time, they came to classify very young children, many were very young indeed, as being securely attached to their caregiver, who was almost always a mother in these experiments, which they framed as being like the good form of attachment, anxiously attached and avoidantly attached. So they had three categories when they started out. But notice how in these original experiments and observations that just what came to be called disorganized attachment or anxious avoidant attachment wasn't even in there. And it was actually quite some time later that Mary Ainsworth went back through looking at more observations and felt like there really needed to be a fourth category talking about these infant attachment styles. That became known as anxious avoidant and also disorganized, depending on who you're reading. I should add that this research has had a lot of support from many different cultures, while also being criticized a lot for being extremely simplistic. However, it does seem to have a fair bit of predictive power when it comes to talking about children. But always, one of the biggest criticisms about this with regards to children and adults as well is that it's really never clear how much attachment is the property of an individual versus a relationship dynamic. So people would debate, right? Like you'd see these children and they would have, obviously distressed relationships with their mothers, but sometimes they would be quite okay with their fathers or vice versa. And so there was a lot of argument over whether or not this mattered. And also in what way it might matter, right? So like how does it affect an individual if they have a positive relationship with one caregiver and not the other growing up? Like how would that like change anything, et cetera, et cetera. And this question really haunts this literature in some pretty profound ways, because it does seem to be true that the way that people relate to other people can be characterized in terms of, you know, positive or certain types of like dysfunctional relationship styles. But to the degree that that is a matter of the individual versus like a particular person who they're relating to is never clear. And that really becomes like a haunting question for this literature, and also this entire sort of theoretical paradigm. That said, I think the general consensus among its supporters, and to some degree, frankly, even me, who is not really one of its supporters, is that, it probably is both, right? That the way that we relate to other people is a constant product of ourselves plus our particular way that we happen to relate with a given person. And ultimately, I think this is like the basic fundamental thing that this quote unquote theory is arguing, in very much the same way that you can simplify Freud down to like, hey, what happened with your parents matters. But then there's a lot of other garbage in Freud. And when it comes to attachment theory, unfortunately, there's also a lot of other garbage. And that's because both of them are ultimately classified as psychoanalysis, even though Balbi was extremely unpopular with the psychoanalytics of his time. But even by the 1970s, there was growing consensus that this theory was best understood in the very specific context where it originated, which is to say, very young children with their parents and mostly with their mothers. And the idea of generalizing it beyond that was pretty tricky. I think understanding a relatively simple way that young children might relate to caregivers makes sense because probably young children have less complicated personalities than adults, although I suppose that's a question that is, as a professor of mine in graduate school would say, an empirical question, which is to say something that one could try to test. Worth noting, as I mentioned earlier, that around the same era, behaviorists were already starting to pick up on these concepts. So behaviorism, which I will talk much more about later, is a school of psychology that emphasizes the way that reinforcement, both positive and negative, influences our behavior. And it's strongly associated with B.F. Skinner. You probably heard as an undergraduate about the way that he used to torment these poor dogs with lights and bells and ways of feeding them. But it turns out that a lot of the same principles do, in fact, apply to people. And so the idea that the way that people interact with you, especially at a very young age, talking about caregivers in positive and negative ways, we're like, oh, hey, maybe that is actually what's going on here. But I'll come back to that in more depth in a bit. So we have this theory that is trying to articulate or categorize the way that infants relate to caregivers. And then a couple decades later, a couple of psychologists named Cindy Hazan and Philip Shaver decided to try to apply this paradigm to romantic relationships, so like circa 1987. Remember that disorganized attachment was an afterthought in the original set of categories for infants. And it's worth noting that it was also an afterthought in the way that Hazan and Shaver ended up theorizing romantic attachments as well. But let's talk about Hazan and Shaver. You might be hoping that they followed a sophisticated methodology that psychologists typically employ when they're trying to create these kinds of categories, which is called factor analysis. Basically, very, very simplistically, I will frankly say it's not a statistical formulation that I'm personally familiar with, but it is a way to categorize information using math. You get like a bunch of information that you would try to ask people about the way that they are in relationships, and then you would try to stick them into categories using computer models. I don't know that that was the standard in 1987, and it's definitely not what they did. Instead, what they did was they got 620 respondents from a newspaper and 108 undergraduates to answer some questions. And these were questions that they had formulated around the assumption that these three existing categories of attachment of secure, anxious, and avoidant were real. So they were questions like, for secure, I find it relatively easy to get close to others and I'm comfortable depending on them and having them depend on me. I don't often worry about being abandoned or about someone getting too close to me. And for avoidant, I am somewhat uncomfortable being close to others. I find it difficult to trust them completely, difficult to allow myself to depend on them. I'm nervous when anyone gets too close, and often love partners want me to be more intimate than I am comfortable being. And then for anxious ambivalent, I find that others are reluctant to get as close as I would like. I often worry that my partner doesn't really love me or won't want to stay with me. I want to merge completely with another person, and this desire sometimes scares people away. So they also note in their own conclusion in this paper that it's not entirely clear whether attachment theory is talking about individuals or relationships. So same problem that I already mentioned. But also, I find it amazing that this was like the sum total of the ways that they imagined that people could be in relationships with one another. And also to think for a moment that you could characterize the bad ways of being relationships with people into only two groups. They're also suffering from the fact that, you know, people often have limited dating relationship experience, right? Like, it's, you may not realize it from popular media, but it's surprisingly common to have only ever been in one or two relationships in your life. And so what are people generalizing from when they answer these questions? I interviewed 30 couples, male, female couples for my in long-term relationships for my dissertation. And I would ask them a lot of questions about, you know, falling in love and deciding to date. And I also asked them about their previous relationships as well. And, you know, that's some of what I draw from as I think about my criticisms here, but also my own dating experience and spending a lot of time talking to other people. And in particular, just being polyamorous, I think, gives you a very different perspective here, because you know that not only can you be different in the way that you relate to different people because you've been and had a lot of relationship experience, but also you can know that you can relate to people differently, even at the same time in your life, so that it's not just about a phase. And I have not verified this, but at least when I was reading the book Polysecure, which I do not recommend, in one of the studies at the end that they're citing says, oh yeah, it turns out that the study found that polyamorous people could be in different relationship attachment styles with different partners, which I think really speaks to the fact that this whole system is just very, very weak in terms of the available categories, but also that it just does not really understand the difference between something that's a property of an individual versus a property of a relationship dynamic. So disorganized attachment isn't even part of this original formulation. And then it starts to pop up around the same time, actually, in 1990 with researchers named Main and Solomon talking about disorganized attachment with regards to children, picking up on Ainsworth's observations that there's like seems to be this fourth category. And then Hazan and Shaver end up picking up on it several years later themselves. And the idea of disorganized attachment was basically supposed to be that there's this fourth category that doesn't feel that necessarily well understood, that seems to have properties of both anxious attachment and avoidant attachment, and kind of pushes and pulls between the two in some very particular ways. And I'm going to quote a researcher named Gaskins writing in 2013, who says, the category is really just a residual one and might be seen more productively as evidence of the inadequacy of the three attachment classifications, unquote. And so for a long time, researchers were trying to get by with single question measures to ask people about their romantic attachment styles. And I just need to make sure that you understand what I mean by that. So like, originally, Hazan and Shaver have like these like three or four questions to try to measure people's attachment style with like the romantic partner that they feel like has had the biggest impact on their life or something, I think is approximately how they phrase that. And then eventually researchers just get increasingly lazy with this and literally just try to ask single questions to try to get people to like stick themselves into these boxes that no one has ever actually bothered to verify. However, by 2000, they had developed an actual scale that multiple people had used. But you have to understand the way that these things get validated. So, like, this isn't necessarily validating it against other possible ways of formulating this process. This is just trying to sort of validate it against itself. So, like, does it measure the thing that the researchers believe matters rather than like trying to measure something else? And no one in here is doing factor analysis. Then by 2017, researchers decided that they should incorporate disorganized attachment into their theories of romantic relationships more. And so they are looking at that based on, again, this finding that seems to be popping up in the real world of their romantic relationship studies, just as it did with children, that that doesn't seem like the three categories is sufficient to really cover all the territory, and that there, in fact, does seem to be this other category that they hadn't really thought about before that matters. I think it's really important to note in this process that whereas the other three categories of secure, anxious, and avoidant sort of showed up almost like not really based on sort of a priori, like people sort of seem to think that those were already there. It's disorganized attachment that shows up from actual research and observations. And I think this is a big part of why, even though I think the other three categories are frankly pretty useless, that the category of disorganized attachment is almost sort of accidentally like real. And by that I mean that it's based on real world observations, it's based on actual like noticing of things and an intelligent like looking back at the process and saying, hey, this seems like it probably could fit into this thing, but we didn't think that it was there before. That said, there's just not a ton of research here for on adults and romantic relationship attachment. There's some, but most of it is just based on the assumption that attachment theory already works. Like there's almost nothing testing alternate hypotheses or theories. And even though one of the studies that I think was in 2017, I'm going to say that I'll have links to some of these studies in the podcast that really tried to science attachment theory more. I was looking at adults, but like wasn't really focusing on romantic relationships per se. Even that study, as it was trying to science things more, like tried to divide things out into eight categories instead of four to see where it took them. And this was the group that ended up like really affirming the existence of disorganized attachment, at least according to their own research. And so the general state of findings here on romantic relationships and disorganized attachment says that people with disorganized attachment crave intimacy but are terrified of it at the same time. They're characterized as being the masters of the mixed signal, where they go from seeming totally into you to very distant very quickly for seemingly no reason or explanation. They tend to shut down easily from conflict, which makes resolution very difficult. They tend to pick weirdly unsuitable partners. Their responses to stressful situations with partners are often unpredictable, even to them. And I will say, having dated to people who identify as having disorganized attachment, that like it's pretty hard for me to argue with the reality of this. Like, this is a surprisingly accurate description of what these people can be like in relationships. But I was confused by the fact that this seemed to be true because, as I thought back on pretty much every other relationship that I'd ever been in, most of them didn't really fit into this existing four quadrant system, right? Like if secure, avoidant, or anxious, or disorganized. Like most of the people that I've dated, I couldn't at all put into this topology in terms of the nature of the dysfunction of our relationship. It's like, oh, well, this person, like, and mostly their relationship was pretty good, but they had undiagnosed obsessive compulsive personality disorder. They had literally, like, basically every symptom, and they were untreated, and that made it really difficult to try to be in a relationship with them. Or, like, this person had extremely severe ADHD, and, like, Mild degrees of narcissistic personality disorder in ways that made it very difficult to be in a relationship with them, or like this person had extremely severe, untreated, and mostly undiagnosed complex PTSD. So it made it very difficult to be in a relationship with them. And would I say, oh, this person was anxious or this person was avoidant? Or no, I wouldn't describe them that way at all. Like, I have a whole other set of ways that I would describe them. And so, like, when I look at those relationships, I'm like, this doesn't really match this thing at all. Like, the overwhelming experience for me of being in a relationship with those people was their poorly treated and often undiagnosed mental illness. Also, like, untreated, pretty severe bipolar two. Let's see, someone else had untreated, undiagnosed gender dysphoria that was like causing them extreme anxiety. And like, these were the things that I felt were compelling about the way that they were able to be in a relationship with me, and that made it very dysfunctional. And like, I have no way to describe the way that they are related to me in terms of this topology. But the two people that I had relationships with who described themselves as having disorganized attachment, I was like, yeah, no, that completely tracks. I also want to add that, like, when I was doing interviews with people in 2006, 2007, for my dissertation, like, the way that they would talk about their relationships, when they would talk about problematic relationships, they mostly talked about them frequently framing them in terms of somebody else's like untreated, unmanaged, undiagnosed mental illness, at least as they perceived it, right? Like, we're not professionals. This is just the way that you see it being in a relationship with somebody. Obviously, attachment theory with regards to romantic relationships really wasn't part of popular discourse back then, especially straight popular discourse. So it would have been quite surprising if they had framed it in that way. But overwhelmingly, I think when people talked about their relationship problems, they tended to frame them much more as being about the struggles of being with a person with X mental illness, especially X, Y, and Z mental illnesses, than they did about like a specific way of somebody relating to them. But when I looked back over my own relationship history, the fact that disorganized attachment seemed to ring true to me made me really ponder for a minute, like, hey, like, could this be real? And if it is real, why would it be in the midst of the rest of the theory that I think is mostly not so great? And I was especially very skeptical of it initially because as I was reading over the symptoms of disorganized attachment, I was like, this sounds an awful lot like borderline personality disorder. Like, what even is the difference between this and borderline personality disorder? And the answer is not a lot, honestly. Like, definitely there are people who show up in studies with disorganized attachment who don't have borderline personality disorder, but as far as I can tell, it's pretty hard to have borderline personality disorder and not have disorganized attachment, especially if your borderline is untreated. And also, a variety of other personality disorders are associated with having disorganized attachment as well, but BPD really stands out. And in case you're not familiar with what borderline personality disorder is, often abbreviated to BPD, it's associated with having unstable emotions, an inability to define, identify, regulate, and manage one's emotions primarily. It's also related to impulsivity, self-image, and dot 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 difficulty managing relationships. It's also really important to emphasize as I talk about this that I supposedly like population screeners say that men and women probably experience BPD at almost the same rates, but men are almost never diagnosed. So I think it's not a coincidence that a lot of our popular cultural perceptions of disorganized attachment, which to some degree overlaps extremely strongly with BPD, that we often associate that with men because they don't have any other diagnosis. Or it's like, oh, well, they have this attachment disorder because that's the only thing that we have to really sort of explain why they're so bad at being in relationships. If you're curious, like, what these symptoms are, like, around 75% of BPD men are estimated to have had substance abuse problems. So on the rare occasions when they do actually get diagnosed with this, it's usually picked up in rehab. They're more likely to have issues with aggressiveness, impulsivity, and anger problems. They tend to engage in novelty-seeking behavior because they get bored easily. If we're talking about BPD women, they are more likely to self-harm. They have eating disorders, other mood disorders. Both can be very suicidal. And really, when you come right down to it, like if somebody tells you that they have disorganized attachment, like your next question should be, have you ever been screened for borderline personality disorder? And yeah, some people do have disorganized attachment without having BPD. But it's really common for them to overlap. Also, it's further complicated by the fact that there's sort of like the secondary diagnosis of like borderline personality disorder, where like you're not all the way there to be labeled with BPD. But generally speaking, if you're in that category of person, you will probably benefit from dialectical behavioral theory, otherwise known as DBT. And it's worthwhile potentially to seek that out. But after having encountered some people who clearly didn't have borderline, but definitely did have disorganized attachment, I was curious as to why I thought I was looking for alternative explanations for how this would come to be. And that's why I'd like to change lenses now to start talking about behaviorism. So behaviorism is a psychological theory paradigm, it's a paradigm, not a theory, that works really well for explaining certain behaviors in certain contexts. So for example, it's great for explaining phobias, and it's certainly for treating phobias. And it's great for explaining and treating a very specific set of behaviors and symptoms. But it sometimes struggles to really treat others. And often many people perceive it as lacking empathy, which is understandable because I think perhaps that's fair. However, it often is very accurate. And behaviorists started to pick up on the idea of like attachment because it seems pretty intuitive, right? Like if a kid asks for a hug and the parents consistently yell at them, the kids are going to respond in some way, right? Especially over time. And it probably wouldn't even take very long. If a kid asks for a hug and parents respond happily, kids are going to respond in a certain way, especially if it stays the same over time. And if a kid asks for a hug and sometimes they get it and sometimes they don't with seemingly no explanation, and then they're going to respond in a certain way. And if a kid asks for a hug and sometimes they get yelled at and sometimes they get the hug and again with no explanation and there's a certain randomness to get this, probably again they're going to respond to this in a certain way over time. And if you go back to like the original studies where they were looking at dogs for this, right? So they would like flash a light and then they would give a dog food and they would like see if the dog salivated or they'd like ring a bell. They did lots of these. And they also eventually did studies that were a lot meaner that involved shocking these poor dogs and seeing what happened to them. These were studies pertaining to learned helplessness. You find some really unfortunate, sad effects, right? So in the case of being fed, like if you regularly shock the dog when they're about ready to get fed, then they start to have really problematic symptoms, which is unsurprising because they've learned to associate needing food and being hungry with being hurt. And it's really sad, but it's especially sad when something like this happens to people. So if you have a basic thing in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, like love, and then you find yourself constantly being, well, not even constantly, but especially oftentimes being severely hurt as you seek out love and affection, then you can develop a really problematic relationship with love and attachment. You can think about the types of applications for this, what's called reinforcement in the real world. When you watch your friends trying to apply for jobs and you are just like, you send out 100 applications and you hear nothing. If you're a writer, you just send out like 50 samples to agents and hear nothing, or you just get nothing but a series of rejections, right? You tend to start to give up and like feel really helpless. And that's what happens if you are consistently negatively reinforced in this case. You just like give up and stop trying, right? The same thing also happens with regards to online dating a lot of times. If you're a guy and you send out like 1,000 messages and you hear nothing back, you tend to give up, right? That's learned helplessness for you. But there's a potentially worse version of this thing, which is intermittent reinforcement. So if you really want something to stick for somebody, the most effective thing to do, or an animal, any mammal been tested on, intermittent reinforcement is the way that you really make something stick around, negatively or positively. So, for example, slot machines, right? They are designed to occasionally pay out. Sometimes they pay out a little bit, sometimes they pay out big. They do it just often enough that you keep thinking, maybe it'll work this time. And so it's easy for them to become addictive. But you can think about intermittent negative reinforcement in like a relationship context where sometimes when you come home, your partner yells at you for no, for because of or like a reason, like, or at least they'll pretend like there's a reason. But maybe it's only like actually once a week that this happens. And that's really different than if they yell at you every single day. There's both, they cause very different effects in terms of how that damages your psychology and in terms of how you end up relating to that person. So if they yell at you every single day, then you begin to understand, typically, that it's out of your control. Like this isn't like you, it's much easier if they always yell at you for you to comprehend that it's not about you. The problem isn't you. Like, obviously, children sometimes struggle with this a little bit more than adults do, but typically, you're more likely to come to the conclusion of it's not actually about me. If they only yell at you sometimes, however, then you can start inventing reasons for why they didn't yell at you the other times. And you can start convincing yourself that it's possible that if you just did things differently, then they wouldn't yell at you the other times either. Right. And so the same thing happens with the way that parents interact with their children. The same thing happens in relationships. And you can construct an entirely different kind of unhealthy relationship if somebody is unkind to you sometimes than if they are unkind to you all the time. Which is to say that in general, studies of reinforcement show that we get the most damaging to ourselves outcomes. Usually, when circumstances are unpredictable and feel like, for whatever reason, whether true or untrue, that they are out of our control. And like there, when there feels like there's no relationship between your skill, effort, and action, and whatever the outcome is, that creates a lot of problems in terms of how you relate to another person and also within your own psyche. And I think it's not a difficult stretch to imagine that people who tend to exhibit disorganized attachment tendencies found themselves often in relationships where it felt like what they did had no effect on what the outcome of the relationship was. Basically, it's like you put forth tons of effort, and sometimes the outcome is negative, and sometimes it's positive. You put forth little effort. Sometimes it's negative, sometimes it's positive. It feels like there's very little relationship between what you did and what happens. And so I think you can sort of frame that as like relationship learned helplessness. And then also this tendency for people with disorganized attachment to pick people who are just like bizarrely and obviously wrong for them, I think becomes part of the cycle of like, well, obviously it's not going to work. And sort of like reinforce the fact for themselves that it's not going to work. Moreover, if you are trying to be in any sort of relationship with someone with disorganized attachment, obviously it's going to be hard for the other person because they're experiencing the same thing now, right? Where like you put out, like sometimes you're really into them and sometimes you're not, without any real thing having necessarily to do with them, which is going to make almost any reasonable person either anxious or anxious and avoidant themselves, right? Like where you're going to have this tangled relationship with the way that the other person is experiencing you. If you are giving them lots of positive reinforcement followed by a withdrawal of that positive reinforcement. And even worse, if it's negative, right now you're creating that same cycle and it just goes on and on. But I think that we could really develop better strategies for treating, understanding, and comprehending this experience if we framed it more as what the inevitable result of feeling out of control in your relationships, and like, what do you have to do in order to get that sense of control back? And it's very difficult, right? Like, treating learned helplessness from the literature is quite challenging. But I think we could, if we had, you know, worked on framing this as part of a behavioral context, understand this more as a learned helplessness behavior and try to take it out of this weird theoretical framework of secure, anxious, and avoidant, none of which I think really matches much of the world that I've seen. I think perhaps it makes sense to see people who are avoidant because they're the ones probably who've experienced consistent negative reinforcement when it comes to relationships, plausibly. Anxious people, I'm not really sure. And the literature isn't really sure either. It's secure. I don't know. I'm pretty sure there's a whole lot of other things that are going on here. And it just so happens that, yes, some people are actually avoidant because they've experienced consistent negative reinforcement. But the rest, I think there's a lot of other possibilities. And I think that we should be exploring those possibilities. And I also think that a huge, like, place for psychology as a discipline to go is really to be looking more at the interplay between humans, right? Like, historically, the discipline has been very focused on self. And I think attachment theory as a paradigm is filling in this big gap in this overarching disciplinary sort of absence, right, of like not really looking that much at the way that people end up relating to one another. And I think it'd be much more productive if we started paying attention to like what kinds of relationships tend to form between someone with, say, bipolar 2 and someone who doesn't have bipolar 2, or two people with bipolar 2, or a person with CPTSD with somebody with bipolar 2. Those are the types of combos that I think we could really gain a lot of insight from. And just like focusing on these four attachment styles, I think is, you know, it may be potentially a starting off point, but there's so many other places that we could go. I also think that part of why this theory has been so appealing to queer folks is because mainstream psychology has really not done us a solid in terms of our own experiences. And I'm currently working on a book on this topic, which is part of why I am doing this particular episode. I'm not doing a book on attachment theory, and this will probably never appear in any of my published writings, at least maybe not beyond anything that ever shows up on my blog. But I am looking a lot at bisexual mental health right now. And it's really common among almost all of the queer femmes of my acquaintance to have been bounced back and forth between diagnoses of ADHD, complex PTSD, bipolar 2, depression, anxiety, and sometimes occasionally a bonus of borderline. And yet, even though they often have symptoms of all of these things, none of them really seems to tell the whole story. And so they're just existing in this unfortunate state of not being well treated, while also not having like anything that really seems to explain their experience. And so I think as mainstream psychology has really failed to pick up on these experiences, and please note too that as far as I know, the DSM-5 still does not have CPTSD in it as a diagnosis, even though it has become widely accepted within a lot of popular culture, especially. You know, when science fails us, when good science fails us, I think we tend to go elsewhere for explanations. Another reason why I think astrology tends to be popular among queers, because it offers us an explanation for why we are the way we are that mainstream psychology has mostly failed to provide us with. And so, you know, if there's any research psychologists, especially out there listening to this, I hope that you'll start thinking more and theorizing more and researching more about what happens when people are in relationships with each other when they're not well. And I realize that if your, you know, sample world consists entirely of monogamous straight people that like maybe you have too many people who are doing well to really do a good job answering that question. But I can tell you sadly from my studies of queer mental health that if you really want to see all the different ways that people can be doing badly, come hang out in queer communities and then watch us try to have relationships with each other. And the answer is that, like, you know, frankly, we're a mess. Like, I wish that weren't true, but we're a mess. And I think we're really desperately seeking some way to account for the way in which we are a mess. And especially as we try so hard to love one another. But a lot of us are hurt. And because we come to our relationships already hurting, then we end up hurting our partners. And then hurt partners go out and hurt other people. Like we have a lot of problems. Like I'm not going to pretend like we don't. And my book on bisexuals is going to be rough. but I think it's also really important to recognize the way that mental illness can spread through social networks and the way that we hurt one another can spread through social networks. And I think having attachment as a concept be so weakly theorized and researched really makes it difficult to fully appreciate, recognize, and understand the way that when we come to relationships with mental illness and trauma, and then we are with our partners, the way that we often don't leave them better than we found them. But I think if we had therapies that were better theorized, better understood, better appreciated, better appreciating of the way that our relationships have shaped us, that we would be in a better position to be able to genuinely help one another. You know, as long as we're sticking to this, you know, psychoanalytic framework that imagines that so much of our who we are in relationships comes from our parents. Like, yeah, sure, they had an influence on us, but so do all the other people who we've loved. And, you know, especially if you're talking about queer folks, like a lot of times our peers and the people who we ended up in relationships with often had a much bigger impact in a lot of ways, at least, on the way we relate to one another than our families did. Like one of the reasons why I became so interested in and then like very skeptical of these theories of attachment that I was reading was like, oh, looking over this story of like how the children interacted with their parents or whatever. Like, I had a pretty vivid memory of myself as a child and like, oh, right. So like if someone had correctly looked at me, like I would have been designated as like avoidantly attached or whatever. And I was like, well, that doesn't really seem to accurately characterize my experience as an adult. And I'm like, well, yeah, because the first person who I got into a relationship with, who I'm still married to as a teenager, we both had like a really healthy relationship with how we wanted to be with one another. We were very supportive. We were very loving. Like imagining myself having gotten into my first relationship with as a teenager with some of the people who I dated later in my life, I'm like, wow, I'd be really fucked up from that. And some therapist who was listening to me talk at that point would be like, oh yeah, well, the reason why you have so much trouble in these relationships is because your mom was in a mental hospital when you were 17 and because you grew up with a severely mentally severe parents who were really not doing well. Like, yeah, that definitely had an impact on my life. I'm not going to pretend like it doesn't. But in terms of the romantic way that I interact with my partners nowadays, decades later, I feel like the thing that really had an impact on me was my relationship with my friends in high school who were loving and supportive, albeit also many of them very mentally ill. And, you know, a partner who really was also very loving and supportive, albeit also very mentally ill. Like, these are the things that shape me. And I think as long as our conceptualization is so overly focused on the way that we related to our parents when we were small children, it does us a big disservice in terms of being able to better conceptualize how, you know, our early romantic attachments influence later romantic attachments. But especially when you're talking about people who are queer, like we come to our relationships frequently with these backgrounds of, you know, not so great things coming from our families and not so great things coming from people who we love. And you know, when we combine those together, like sometimes it's beautiful and supportive, which I was very fortunate, and that's what happened with my spouse. Both of us had mothers who'd been in mental hospitals in the last year, and we like bonded over that as teenagers. But like sometimes that's not how things go, right? And I think it's beautiful that there's a bit more psychological studies nowadays on resilience. But in general, I think we need to see more about how we end up in relationships with one another, and particularly the ways that different kinds of mental illness affects our ability to be in relationships with one another, and less focus on like identifying in this four quadrant paradigm, where one of the quadrants I think just so happens to be pretty well delineated because that was the one where they did the research in a more ground up kind of way, which is ideally the way that you do this kind of research. Thank you for listening to me rant and rave about this topic, which I have fairly strong feelings about as a result of having spent a number of years in relationships with people with disorganized attachment now. As I said, I don't have any published writings on this particular topic, but I am currently working on a book on bisexual mental health that will hopefully be out in a couple of years. That's a long way from being finished. I do want to caveat here at the end of the episode, I am not a psychologist. I am a sociologist by training. Yes, I do and have studied queer mental health in particular for a while now, but I study it as a sociologist, which is a rather different perspective. And also, sociology of mental health tends to be a fairly critical discipline in general. But in my next episode, I will be, in the next couple of episodes, I'm going to be talking about things that I know a great deal about professionally and personally, which is gender and BDSM roles. So, whereas this episode has been drawing much more from personal experience and a little bit from research that I conducted on just reading over other people's studies and criticizing them, the next couple episodes are going to be based on my own research on the BDSM subculture. Thank you for listening.